She was so private, I don't know that she could have done it like you did. It's amazing, it really is.
And Sheila, what do you say to parents of young women or young men today?
I really feel in my heart that it has to start with conversations in the home. You know, parents talking to their sons about the way they treat women and, you know, about being responsible, about being men, you know, being the example. And I feel the same way about young women. It's not about being popular. It's not about having the boys like you. It's about being true to yourself and taking care of your friends. There was something that one of the probation officers said to us in our criminal trial. And she said, Audrey needed a hero that night, and no one stood up. And so when we speak to high school students through the foundation, and I ask these young people, you know, to be the hero.
Well, Sheila Pott and Daisy and Melinda Coleman, thank you so much. That's Sheila Pott. Her daughter Audrey hanged herself after she was sexually assaulted. Sheila met Daisy Coleman and her mom Melinda for the first time at this interview about the documentary Audrey and Daisy. That does it for the show. Special thanks to Amy Littlefield and Laura Gottesdiener. I'm Amy Goodman from Park City Television in Utah.
KBOO Portland. The time is 5 p.m. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
Hi, this is John Chuck, host of Religion for Life. I'm beginning a series called Islam 101, Meet Your Muslim Neighbor. I'll be talking with local Muslims in the Portland area, as well as Quranic scholars. This week, I speak with Ali Hadroj of the Islamic Center of Portland.
Find weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/religionforlife.
Eyes for Allah, nothing but Allah. Ba is the beginning of Bismillah. Ta is for taqwa, the wearing of a...
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the film screening of Warrior, The Life of Leonard Peltier, Saturday, February 6th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Warrior tells the true story of Leonard Peltier, the American Indian leader locked away for life in Leavenworth Penitentiary. Warrior takes us back to the violent confrontations at Pine Ridge and Wounded Knee in the 70s, and through Peltier's harrowing odyssey through the American justice system. Leonard's son, Chauncey Peltier, will hold a Q&A after the film. Again, that's Warrior, The Life of Leonard Peltier, Saturday, February 6th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the four-week standoff at the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge appears to be winding down.
The signature Ivy Island traffic island in St. John's is currently up for removal.
And an investigation into the Wounded Warrior Project charity revealed extravagant expenditures by its managers.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, January 29th, 2016. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Liam Delta. The nearly month-long takeover of a wildlife refuge in Oregon appears to be coming to an end, with just four people remaining at the site this morning. 11 of the group's members now in federal custody, and one of their leaders dead. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg, reporting with our friends at freespeechradionews.org, has more.
After Tuesday night's arrest of Ammon Bundy, the self-proclaimed leader of the takeover, and the fatal shooting of another member of the group by police, most of the people who had set up camp in the Malheur Wildlife Refuge since January 2nd began to move out. The FBI released video late Thursday of the traffic stop that led to the fatal shooting of Lavoy Finicum earlier in the week. Officers say they thought Finicum was about to pull a gun out of his jacket, and while he does appear to be reaching into his jacket in the video, he had no gun in his hand when he was shot. The stated aim of the armed militants was to seize control of public land like the wildlife refuge and turn it over to private landowners. But though some in the community had in the past criticized federal land management, very few participated in the takeover. In fact, many local residents protested the arrival of the militants, including members of the Burns Paiute tribe, like Jarvis Kennedy.
What would they do if I went into their cemeteries where their grandparents are buried and sitting there occupied and driving heavy equipment around over their graves? You know, I could always go out and loot their cemetery, but I have more respect than that.
There you go.
So does my people.
During the last several weeks, the small town of Burns, Oregon, has been besieged by the small group of mainly out-of-state militants who took over the wildlife refuge and began setting up a self-styled base for what they call an anti-government revolution. Jenka Soderberg, FSRN, Portland.
Rising housing costs threaten the stability of families with low and middle incomes across the Portland metropolitan area. That is especially true for people of color. Solutions being tried by other cities might work here, such as legal protections for tenants and tax incentives for developers to build more affordable units. These were some of the findings published last week by Metro, the regional government that oversees development in Portland and 24 neighborhood cities. Metro's report was part of a year-long equitable housing initiative which studied the social and economic impacts of rising housing costs. The report also suggests policies to help soften those impacts. On Monday, Metro will host an Equitable Housing Leadership Summit in Portland. The 200-plus invited guests include elected officials, developers, and affordability advocates. They will also hear from Seattle Mayor Ed Murray to compare how another metropolitan region is facing its own housing crisis.
The future of the signature traffic island in St. John's called Ivy Island is currently up in the air. Developer Fareed Balori is working with the Portland City Council to remove the traffic island to make room for a new apartment complex. But residents are not happy about this change to the gateway of St. John's. KBOO reporter Brandon Wiley stopped by Ivy Island to speak to protesters.
My name is Shay Wishna. We're a group called Save Ivy Island.
Okay.
And this is Ivy Island here, Traffic Island. There's currently Mr. Balori over here as a developer. He's got a big development coming called the Union at St. John's. And so there's currently a proposal about to go in front of our city council that wants to give Mr. Balori our public land, vacate Ivy Island and the Lombard Slip Lane, which is this right here. In exchange, he's going to do quote-unquote traffic improvements. And he would build his buildings about midway into Ivy Island, big buildings, four stories. The justification for this is something called the St. John's Lombard Plan, which is 11 years old, which the citizens of St. John's and PBOT and the city government put together 11 years ago. We like to refer to Mr. Balori's development as the fake Lombard Plan, because nowhere in the Lombard Plan did it say we are going to give away our public land, our commons, and he's going to build buildings, tall four-story buildings, on our gateway. This is the gateway to St. John's. We believe so strongly that place is the fabric that connects us as a community, and that it's important with a place that you can see as you're approaching that there's a gateway.
How do you feel about the changes that are happening up here in St. John?
Yeah, they've discovered us, and it's happening all over the city, and we feel so strongly that now is the time to take a stand, because developers aren't in it for the greater good, you know, but people like you and me, it's like I grew up with like the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. And, you know, quality of life is so important. And when these develop, nobody who lives here now is going to be able to afford to live in the Union at St. John's. And the only ones who are going to have this nice view of the bridge are going to be the people who live on the top floors. So democracy works, but you have to take a stand. You got to show up.
But I just don't see why we would be willing to give it away. You know, and one thing, a husband and wife came here to sign our petition, and he said, if I lived in this new development, I would rather look down out my apartment at tall trees and birds than a giant intersection. I thought that was pretty relevant. We are focused on saving the gateway to St. John's. We think it adds value to the community, and I would encourage everybody else that is interested to come down and talk to us next Saturday between 12 and 2, and look us up, saveivyisland.weebly.com.
If you would like to be a part of the conversation of the future of Ivy Island, there will be a town hall meeting tonight at 6 p.m. at Patty's Home Plate Cafe in St. John's. The address is 8501 North Lombard Street. For KBOO News, I'm Brandon Wiley.
Homelessness in Portland has become more visible after the mayor directed police to cut back enforcements of anti-camping rules prohibiting tents. The undisclosed policy shift that took effect 7 weeks ago has been something of an open secret among homeless Portlanders, according to the Oregonian. The rise in campers follows the Portland City Council declaring a housing emergency last fall, as well as new federal guidelines discouraging the criminalization of homelessness. Since December, any homeless sweeps must be personally approved by the mayor's top aide before they are conducted until new rules can be considered next month. As a result, police have leniently enforced tent rules except in cases of blatant law-breaking or extremely large camps. Yesterday, a group of frustrated residents and business leaders demanded an explanation from the mayor. The mayor told the Oregonian that the current camping reprieve is temporary until new rules can be considered next month. He declined to discuss any proposed changes, but hopes they'll provide balanced enforcement with new options for the nearly 1,900 residents estimated to sleep on our streets each night.
The Oregon Department of Transportation is accepting public input as part of its Transportation Safety Action Plan. State safety strategist Walt McAllister says the department is collecting ideas from the public, and the next step is to evaluate them and secure funding. KBOO's Lisa Loving talked to him about what's on the table and how Oregonians can weigh in.
The challenge with funding is that there are many, many things that people would like to see accomplished by the state of Oregon and individual communities. And trying to balance all of those desires and keep safety as the highest priority is the reason why we're preparing this plan. The department is not... The problems of improving safety on Oregon's roadway are not strictly limited to the Department of Transportation. It's going to take every Oregonian saying, this is unacceptable, we need to make a difference, and make the choices that it's going to take to get us there, whether that be a city, county, or the department, or individual motorists choosing a safer car. That's what it's going to take to get us there.
Another question I have, and I know that a lot of our listeners are very concerned about oil trains coming through the state. Mm-hmm. So as you have your open house on this transportation safety action plan, do you guys have any, are you looking at that already, or is that something that you've already been talking about?
The department's already been talking about that, and they have, the rail division has already made some progress on that front. It hasn't come up at the public hearings that we've done so far.
Are you looking at seismic safety or seismic issues as they may impact the highway system or the transportation system in general?
The department is invested in developing a plan for major catastrophes, and seismic lifelines was a specific project that was conducted to look at where the lifelines in the state, and in the event of a seismic event, what's going to be left standing and what's going to need repair. I know that assessment has been conducted. And here's the really great thing about this is they don't have to go down to the safety open house. We have an online tool that gives them the ability to participate. It's not as good as being there in person, but it's almost as good. They can sit down and with a cup of coffee and you know, somewhere between five minutes and a half an hour, depending on how much comment they want to put down, they can basically lay it out for us and it'll all be captured.
Why should people get active right now on this?
It's critical that people take a moment to either attend the session or can do the online exercise, because their input is what's going to drive the conversation as we move forward. We're selecting now. We've laid out the vision. We have an idea what the goals should be based on public input that we've already done. Now we're looking at, well, what are we going to emphasize in the next 5 years as a state? And their input will help shape that conversation.
That was KBOO's Lisa Loving speaking with ODOT safety strategist Walt McAllister. Anyone who wishes can go to their website and file comments online. You can also read the draft plan. Post your comments on the proposed state transportation safety plan at odot.gov and follow the links for safety programs. The site is live through February 9th.
Governor Kate Brown is negotiating with labor unions and the Oregon Business Association on her proposed minimum wage hike in advance of the start of the new legislative session. The governor has laid out plans to raise Portland's workers' base pay to $15.52 and to raise the pay for workers in the rest of the state to $13.50 by the year 2022. Her spokesman declined to tell reporters details of what's being hammered out in the current negotiations. In Seattle, Mayor Ed Murray presided over a new minimum wage in 2014 after long negotiations with business and union leaders. Seattle's compromises included a longer lead-up time to implementation and different requirements for large and small businesses. The new legislative session starts this coming Monday.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop. Portland weather tonight, an 80% chance of showers with a low of 38, and then showers continue throughout the day and into the evening tomorrow with a high of 47. Today in history, in 1969, the Beatles made their last public performance, giving an impromptu concert on the roof of the London recording studio. In April of the following year, Paul McCartney formally announced the group's breakup. The quote of the day is from late Beatle George Harrison. "It is an outrage that people can take other people's lives when they obviously haven't got their own lives in order."
It's 5:17 p.m., time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The word free in free enterprise is not an adjective, it's a verb. As in, let's free up the enterprise of small business people who are locked out of the marketplace by monopoly power. From cable TV to chickens, market after market has been seized by a few corporations, enabling them to set prices, cut quality, and shrink service. We could cry in our beer about that, but even brewskis are falling to monopolists. The latest and biggest example is the proposed merger of Anheuser-Busch InBev with SAB Miller, creating a colossus that would control a third of all beer sales in the world and a whopping 70% of all U.S. sales. Yet the resulting AB InBev behemoth asserts that there'll be no antitrust problems because hundreds of small breweries are popping up like dandelions everywhere, creating a wide-open competition for customers. How free enterprise-y and fallacious. You see, to get customers, first you have to be able to get to them, i.e., be able to get your beers in the bars and on store shelves. That access is mostly controlled in the U.S. by beer wholesalers, and they decide which products they will and will not distribute. Now, guess which big honking beer maker has been aggressively buying up wholesale distributorships in recent years? Yes, AB InBev, giving it the power in various markets to lock out those pesky small breweries. No shelf space, no sales. No sales, no business. This is Jim Hightower saying Anheuser-Busch InBev gloats that it will be the, quote, first truly global brewery. But who cares? We quaffers of the brewer's art don't want one big beer, but many good ones. And this bully is becoming global only by rigging the market to shut down our good beers. To revolt against this monopolizer, contact California Craft Brewers Association at californiacraftbeer.com.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
A nuclear plant in Richland, Washington, is receiving scrutiny this week after a whistleblower's complaint on its safety and performance. The Columbia Generating Station, owned and operated by Energy Northwest, sells its power to the Bonneville Power Authority. The BPA then sells that power to local consumers. After a series of anonymous letters recently sent to the media, the nuclear plant's executive board said it would hire an independent investigator to take a look at the charges. The Columbia nuclear plant posted shutdowns in 2008 and 2009. Afterwards, an industry-led safety panel found it to be one of the two worst-performing nuclear plants in the country. In 2012, the station was relicensed for an additional 20 years by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. That's despite the NRC's finding that it had problems with staff, leadership, and equipment. The plant had gone 6 years without an unscheduled shutdown before a refueling outage last May.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friend at laborradio.org.
Workers Independent News Week in Review. I'm Doug Cunningham.
With all eyes on Iowa, hundreds of fast food workers in Des Moines walked off their jobs Thursday, calling for $15 an hour and a union. WIN's Greta Anderson reports.
They held a series of demonstrations, including a 10-minute march to the Iowa Event Center, where Republican candidates were scheduled to debate Thursday evening. The first demonstration at 6 a.m. drew 150 workers to a McDonald's where Simone Davis makes $7.25 an hour, the federal minimum.
We talked to the rest of our coworkers and they were all on board about it because we all feel like we deserve more. $7.25 isn't enough to even meet in.
Detroit teachers sued the school district Thursday over deplorable conditions that the Detroit Federation of Teachers say are exposing students, teachers, and parents to dangerous environments. The suit says this exposure, if not corrected, will cause irreparable harm to their health, safety, and welfare, and to students' educational opportunities. The suit also seeks dismissal of emergency manager Darnell Early and the restoration of local control for the Detroit School District. The suit was filed by Detroit teachers, affiliated state and national teachers unions, and several parents. In 2011, workers in New Jersey conceded to higher pension and health care contributions in exchange for the state funding the pension. But within 3 years, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie reneged on that commitment and has underfunded the pension by $17 billion in the last 4 years. That's on top of many other years where New Jersey also underfunded the pension system. Hedy Rosenstein, New Jersey State Director for the Communications Workers of America, says that without proper funding, the pension plan is 8 to 12 years from going bankrupt.
If the pension doesn't get funded, it will effectively destroy the economy of New Jersey. I don't think there's any legitimate disagreement about that. We are 8 to 12 years away from Armageddon.
United Steelworkers members rallied for a fair contract at ArcelorMittal's headquarters in Chicago this week. The company is losing money and demanding concessions from its 13,000 union workers. The USW's Mike Millsap says union workers are not the steel industry's problem. It's imports.
They're losing it not because of the employees, not because of the members, but they're losing it because imports are coming in this country. And our government needs to do what's right here. They need to be protecting jobs in the U.S. instead of having these jobs go to China.
Meanwhile, the steelworkers are launching an organizing campaign at the University of Pittsburgh that could bring in thousands of new members. Maria Soma is director of organizing for the United Steelworkers.
We're here because they're workers and because there is a need for workers to always be able to have a say and a seat at the table whenever employers are making decisions that affect these workers' daily lives.
Workers Independent News provided by Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The Wounded Warrior Project has grown rapidly in its 12 years of existence. The charity originally began as a means to dispense small comfort items to veterans. It has grown in its short life to collect over $600 million in donations in the last 2 years alone. However, recently the Wounded Warrior Project has come under fire for its extravagant expenditures and possible mismanagement. Demi Elenius of KBOO News has more.
Recent investigations by the New York Times, CBS News, and other news organizations reveal that some 40% of those donations, $124 million in 2014, have gone to organizations overhead rather than programs benefiting veterans. The charity's director, Steve Nardizzi, a lawyer with no military experience, draws an annual salary of almost $500,000. Many would maintain that its overhead consists largely of wild and unnecessary spending on itself, and point out that it compares unfavorably with other wounded veterans charities. The Semper Fi Fund, for example, typically spends about 8% of donations on overhead. In 2014, Wounded Warrior flew about 500 employees to a meeting in Colorado Springs, putting them up in the five-star Broadmoor Hotel. This, according to former workers, represents the kind of lavish spending that has been typical of the organization for years. With millions spent flying staffers business class throughout the world, ordering expensive dinners, staying in $500 per night hotel rooms, and attending far-flung minor conferences that often seem to have no more rationale than providing perks to employees and managers. The organization has also spent hundreds of thousands of dollars in recent years on public relations and lobbying campaigns intended to counter criticism of its spending, as well as fight legislative efforts to regulate how much it and other nonprofit charities spend on overhead. In 2013, the Wounded Warrior Project gave $150,000 to a nonprofit called the Charity Defense Council, on whose board Nardizzi serves. The council defends charity spending on overhead and executive salaries. In 2014, the Wounded Warrior Project lobbied in California and Florida to fight proposed laws that would have required increased financial transparency on nonprofit groups. The charity was created in 2003 by Marine veteran John Melia to help injured veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan in readjusting to society, attending school, finding work, and participating in athletics. Melia began by visiting military hospitals, distributing backpacks stuffed with socks, CD players, toothpaste, and other items. Among those hired by Melia as the organization grew was Nardizzi. Melia was forced out of the group in 2009. Wounded Warrior uses an aggressive style of fundraising, marketing, and personal management, gaining the cooperation of such companies as Amazon to collect donations for the group on their websites. That aggressive fundraising has led to many current and former employees questioning whether it has drifted from its original mission. Nardizzi maintains that aggressive fundraising and high overhead are necessary for obtaining the kind of funding necessary for such ambitious proposed programs. As a plan of continuing care for veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injuries, the charity recently pledged to raise $500 million for lifetime supplemental health care for severely wounded veterans. But people could spend money on the most ridiculous thing and no one batted an eye, said Connie Chapman, who was in charge of the charity's Seattle office for 2 years. I would fly to New York for less than a day to report to my supervisor. Nardizzi fired Chapman, an Iraq veteran with PTSD, in 2012, as part of a management restructuring, she said. Charity Watch, an independent monitoring group, gave the Wounded Warrior Project a D rating in 2011 and has not given it a grade higher than C since. For KBOO News, I'm Demi Hellenius.
An agreement on police reform measures is being hammered out between the U.S. Department of Justice and the city of Ferguson, Missouri. The DOJ this week asked Ferguson residents to read the agreement and comment for the record on what they think, but they only have 2 weeks to do it in. The agreement calls for several specific reforms. Those include increasing transparency, strengthening accountability, and building community trust. It also requires the Ferguson police to wear working body cameras at all times, to not stop people only to check for warrants, and specifically to state reasonable suspicion and probable cause when writing up reports. Observers say the agreement could cripple the city financially. It's estimated that compliance with DOJ DOJ agreement would cost about $350,000 a year. The Ferguson City Council will decide in mid-February whether to accept or reject the conditions. That's a year and a half after the killing of Michael Brown, an unarmed teenager whose shooting death at the hands of Ferguson police touched off the Black Lives Matter movement. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Brandon Wiley, Demi Hellenius, Mike Wiener, Kristen Yount, Lisa Loving, and David Kesters. The producer is David Kesters. Our engineer is Ian Gadberry. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM on K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson-Osterland.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO, at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on More Talk Radio, Celeste Carey and Cecil Prescott speak with Paul Kawika Martin of Peace Action about the recent deal with Iran and the potential for peace in Syria and North Korea. At 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour, social and political commentary from a socialist feminist point of view. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and comments.